So, hello. Hi. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm Sarah, and I'm an editor of Triple Canopy. We organized this event today as part of our series called Speculations, The Future Is. It's 50 days of lectures and discussions. We've invited technologists, writers, artists, philosophers, scientists to come and think about a future that they might like to see, and then describe that future and think it back into the present day and address what implications it might have for the present day. So coming up over the weekend, we have Agnes Den here on Sunday, the artist, and as well Natalie German-Janko. Those are both on Sunday. On Monday, Lynn Hirschman-Leeson will be joining us as well. So you can pick up a calendar across the hall. Actually, we're entering into our final week. Maybe you can come back for another one. But today we have with us Raymond Brassier. Very honored to have him here. And Ray is a teacher in philosophy at the American University in Beirut. He is also the author of Nile Unbound. And please join me in welcoming him.
Can everyone hear me okay? It's a bit funny with having this thing pointing straight in my head, I understand it's necessary for the recording. So, well, thanks, Sarah. Thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation. I'm going to talk about the topic of my talk is Prometheanism and the philosophical debates about the desirability of the Promethean ambitions, which were sometimes associated with the legacy of the Radical Enlightenment. And I'm going to talk in particular about some philosophically significant critiques of Prometheanism in recent philosophical work, mainly focusing on an essay by Jean-Pierre Dupuis, who's a French philosopher. Dupuis is not very well known, but he wrote a very interesting History of Cognitive Science, published in France in the 90s, which I think it was translated by Princeton, if I'm not mistaken. It's called Introduction to Cognitive Sciences, but it's a very interesting intellectual history of cognitive science, tracing its roots in artificial intelligence. And he recently published, I think, in the middle of the last decade, a book called Towards an Enlightened Catastrophism. The paper I'm focusing on is called Pitfalls in the Philosophical Foundations of Nanoethics. And it's in which Dupuis lays out his what he thinks is wrong with debates about human enhancement and so-called transhumanism, which I assume people are familiar with. So this relates to the topic of the topic for these lectures is speculations, the future is. So I think it's really, once again, it's a question about what does it mean to orient oneself towards the future? And is the future worth investing in? In other words, what sort of relationship can we collectively have towards the future, not just as individual, but as a species? This is a very simple question. The question is, what should we do with time? We know time will do something with us, regardless of what we do or don't do. So should we try to do something with it or to it? This is also to ask what we should do about the future. Should we abandon the future? And the preeminent value afforded to the future in the so-called the modernist project. To abandon the future means to relinquish the intellectual project of enlightenment. And there is no shortage of thinkers urging us to do just that. Its advocates on the right propose to rehabilitate ancient hierarchies mirroring an allegedly natural or divine order. But it also has, this anti-modernism also has, the critique of enlightenment also has many kind of, you know, influential advocates on the left in the 20th century who think that the best we can hope for via radical scaling down of political and cognitive ambition is to achieve small-scale rectifications of universal injustice by establishing local, temporarily fleeting enclaves of civil justice. I mean, it's quite striking so that, you know, in the wake of the alleged, you know, kind of collapse of the communist project, communism as a kind of, well, the Promethean ambitions of communism, there's been a kind of a remarkable scaling down of political ambition by those who espouse the ideals of justice and emancipation. The best you can hope for, apparently, is to try to kind of create little enclaves of, you know, equality and justice. But the idea of remaking the world according to the ideal of equality or justice is routinely denounced as a dangerous totalitarian fantasy. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the kind of the narratives that draw a direct line from, you know, the rationalist, you know, post-Galilean rationalism and the kind of the advocacy of kind of the wholesale rationalization of nature to, you know, the evils of totalitarianism. This is you know, you've all heard this narrative many times before. Now, I want to suggest, so I'm going to try to kind of challenge this philosophical critique of Prometheanism, of Enlightenment Prometheanism. So I'm going to do it conceptually. The cardinal epistemic virtue of enlightenment consists in recognizing the disequilibrium which time introduces into knowing. Knowing takes time, but time impregnates knowing. And enlightenment in this sense, and the rationalist legacy of the Enlightenment, affirms the disequilibrium of time. And this is, for those of you who took part in the discussion of Ballard, this is one of the most interesting, the catastrophic logic that I think is articulated in Ballard's best narratives is about this cognitive appropriation of disequilibrium, which springs time out of joint, restructures the linear succession of past, present, and future. So this disequilibrium is what Hegel called, to affirm this disequilibrium is to do what Hegel called tarrying with the negative, which, as Zizek helpfully points out, is a virtue that Hegel accords to the understanding, the faculty of opposition, rather than reason, the faculty of conciliation. In other words, it's the understanding concept, you know, the understanding which is the faculty of judgment, which dismembers, objectifies, and discriminates. And the point is that this is indispensable to cognition. Before you can presume to overcome an opposition, you have to be capable of articulating it. Therefore, it is a kind of dialectical myopia simply to oppose reason to understanding, or contradiction to judgment. So if disequilibrium is an enabling condition of cognitive progress, then we have to find a way of defending. We have to kind of defend the normative resources or the normative grounds that allow us to make sense of an assertion like this. In other words, we have to defend the normative status of the claim that things are not as they should be, or that things are better, or that things ought to be understood and reorganized. This is the question of what can we make of ourselves? Okay. Again, Prometheanism is the claim that there is no predetermined limit on what we can achieve and the ways in which we can transform ourselves and the world in which we live, okay? So what I want to, this talk today, which, you know, is not, is a kind of a, the sketch or the beginning of a kind of a project that is going to be devoted to Prometheanism, is it's full of, you know, it's I apologize for its incomplete nature, but I'm just trying to kind of lay out some of the basic problems that I think need to be addressed in this debate about the legacy of Enlightenment. It's a question of what can we make of ourselves, and should we simply abjure, should we scale down our ambitions and learn to be modest, as everyone simply kind of seems to be enjoining us to. Prometheanism requires the reassertion of subjectivism, but a subjectivism without selfhood, which articulates an autonomy without voluntarism, because the critique of, you know, the of Prometheanism in the philosophical literature of the 20th century is tied to a critique of metaphysical voluntarism, whose most significant representative is Heidegger, Martin Heidegger. And in fact, there's a line from Dupuis's critique of Prometheanism to Hannah Arendt, who is his chief inspiration, to Heidegger. Which, and it's this lineage that I'm interested in kind of examining today. So, why then is this, why is Prometheanism still not simply kind of an antiquated, you know, metaphysical fancy? Well, because it's still very much alive in the form of the so-called NBIC convergence, okay? The June 2002 report of the National Science Foundation, the American government's National Science Foundation, entitled Converging Technologies for Improving Human Performance, claims that the convergence of nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and cognitive science, aka NBIC, will bring about a transformation of civilization. Okay? So this is, Prometheanism is being espoused by the right. Okay? The advocates of this kind of transformation are advocates of neoliberal capitalism. And the claim that neoliberal capitalism is simply this, is the victor in the narrative about the you know, the possibilities of human history. So why is this, why does it have this transformation, why does NBIC technology have this transformational, this radical transformational capacity? Because it renders possible the technological re-engineering of human nature. This is the claim made by its advocates. So, in this paper, in, you know, Dupuis lays out a very interesting kind of, and, you know, sophisticated philosophical critique of the fallacies and confusion that he takes to underwrite this kind of Prometheanism, this technological Prometheanism. And for Dupuis, the utilitarian prejudices of contemporary bioethical discourse are what prevent it from grasping the properly ontological dimension of the problem of the uses and misuses of NBIC. In other words, he claims that there's a, in fact, I'll read out this, a quote from Dupuis. He says, he claims that the advocates of NBIC and of this, you know, of human enhancement, systematically conflates ontological indetermination as epistemic uncertainty. Okay, they convert what is in fact, you know, an ontological problem, a problem about the structure of reality, into an epistemic problem, a problem about our knowledge. Okay, and Dupuis writes, it sometimes happens that human creative activity and the conquest of knowledge prove to be a double-edged sword, putting in danger the very pursuit of the processes to which it is nonetheless indispensable. In short, it is not that we do not know whether the use of such a sword is a good or a bad thing. It is that it is good and bad at once. Now, the trace, the key influence. So in other words, what does he mean by this? This account of ontological indeterminacy is tied to an account of the nature of human existence, which characterizes it in terms of transcendence. Okay, and this characterization of human existence and what distinguishes humans from other beings, other types of entities, is principally associated with the work of Martin Heidegger in Being and Time. And in fact, this is the root of Dupuy's philosophical inspiration. So what is it that at the root of this, this conflation between an epistemic and an ontological register is based on confusing the human condition with human nature. In other words, claims about the radical malleability of human nature, or the fact that the partisans of human enhancement refuse any theological delimitation of what is proper and improper for human beings to become, is tied to this distinction between nature and condition and essence, okay? The human condition and human nature. So, and here Dupuy writes Hannah Arendt in her book, the book that was translated into English in 1958, I think, called The Human Condition. Okay, and Arendt writes, in addition to the conditions under which life is given to man on earth, and partly out of them, men constantly create their own self-made conditions, which, their human origins and their variability notwithstanding, possess the same conditioning power as natural things. So, it follows then for Dupuy, who's a disciple of Arendt in this debate, that the human condition is an inextricable mixture of things given and things made. You know, in other words, of what human beings generate and produce through their own resources and constraints which they find, the way constraints which transcend their own practical and cognitive abilities. This means that man, to a great extent, can shape that which shapes him, condition that which conditions him, while still respecting the fragile equilibrium between the given and the made. So in other words, this hostility, the root, I think what is fundamental to this philosophical critique of Prometheanism is the claim that there is an equilibrium between what is given and what is made, this fragile equilibrium between what human beings can imminently generate and produce through their own resources and what simply transcends their own, those resources. What is made? Made by God in pre-modern times or made by nature after the Enlightenment? So here again, there's a crucial quotation from Arendt again, which is, illuminating here. And Arendt writes, the problem of human nature, which is the Augustinian questio mihi factus sum, a question I have become for myself, seems unanswerable in both its individual psychological sense and its general philosophical sense. It is highly unlikely that we who can know, determine, and define the natural essences of all things surrounding us, things which we are not, should ever be able to do the same for ourselves. This would be like jumping over our own shadows. Moreover, nothing entitles us to assume that man has a nature or essence in the same sense as other things. In other words, if we have a nature or essence, then surely only a God could know and define it. Now, this is referenced. Now, here, what Arendt is doing, I'd like to suggest, is she's simply, recapitulating Heidegger's ontological radicalization of Kant's claim about the intrinsic finitude of human cognition. Okay, Kant says the human mind is not like God's mind. We are prevented in principle, we're precluded in principle from being able to know the world as in the same way in which God, who created the world, knows the world, because we do not have the faculty of intellectual intuition. God knows everything absolutely, because his thoughts about a thing creates that thing. He has a generative or productive intelligence. So God's knowledge of the world is absolute and incorrigible. For Kant, because we lack this faculty of intellectual intuition, because our access to reality is mediated by our sensory capacities, we can only represent objects, we can only represent things insofar, you know, according to the forms of space and time, and using these basic concepts and categories of the understanding, the human understanding. What transcends human cognition for Kant is simply the created nature of things. The nature of things insofar as they would be understood by their creator, their divine creator, who can grasp everything in its infinite complexity. Our minds are finite, so we have a finite access to the world, and we can only represent things partially, incompletely. Now, what Heidegger does is that he takes this, for Heidegger, Heidegger gives a remarkable account in which it's the fact that human beings have transcend, you know, themselves, transcend any objective determination that can be given of their character or essence, that explains the fact of finitude. In other words, Heidegger ontologizes finitude. He makes finitude and the finitude of human existence into an ontological datum as opposed to an epistemic condition. So Heidegger also says, we can't know things in their infinite and eternal essence as they were created by God. But human beings have this remarkable capacity in that human beings are the locus or the site of a new kind of transcendence. Human beings can't be turned into objects because every process of objectification depends upon the human existence, upon the ways in which we are ecstatically open to the world. And for Heidegger, this involves a kind of an analysis of existential time. Okay? Now, the basic idea, you know, again, what I want to say is that what Arendt says about the distinction between human nature and human essence is simply what Heidegger says. Human beings don't have an essence precisely because they transcend every objective determination that can be given. Human beings exist, but in existing, they transcend every determinate objectification. This is why human existence cannot be an object of scientific study for Heidegger. There's a straightforward kind of ontological argument against this. So it follows then, if one accepts this ontological radicalization of epistemic finitude, that every positive characterization of human nature, whether it's psychological, historical, anthropological, or sociological, is ultimately determined by unavowed metaphysical, and for Heidegger this means theological, prejudices. So in other words, it's very easy for Heideggerians to examine biology, psychology, sociology, and cognitive science and to expose their latent metaphysical prejudices. In other words, the metaphysical presuppositions which determine their basic concepts, which they are themselves incapable of articulating. So then it follows then that Heidegger, and the interesting move here is that philosophers who attributed an essential plasticity to human beings, philosophers who claimed that human beings can radically re-engineer themselves, like Marx, like the young, you know, young Marx, or even Sartre, in a sense, when he espouses in his existential humanism, are actually metaphysicians, okay? So, Marx's claim that man is a species being, this is a quote from Marx's Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, man is a species being, and free conscious activity constitutes the species character of man, end quote. So, for a Heideggerian, for the Heideggerian that Dupuy is, this Marxian account of this Marxian claim about the essential plasticity of human species being is itself a reification of human transcendence. It reifies transcendence as production. Okay? The claim that man is an agent, is a maker, a producer of things, is a metaphysical reification of human existence, according to Heidegger. Similarly, Sartre's claim that man, quote, that man is nothing but what he makes of himself, reifies transcendence in terms of the annihilating power of self-consciousness, or what Sartre called the for itself. Okay, and Heideggerians have, you know, made careers out of denouncing these, you know, spurious metaphysical reifications of what is in Heidegger characterized as an unobjectifiable transcendence, a transcendence of Dasein, which, as some commentators have pointed out, has weird itself is laden with latent theological residues. You know, the way in which theologians talked about God, Heidegger talks about Dasein often as being an absolute. Okay, so here again, there's another this. The root of this conflation of human condition with human essence can be illuminated with another very significant quote from Arendt. Arendt writes, "The human artifice of the world separates human existence from all mere animal environments. But life itself is outside this artificial world. And through life, man remains related to all other living organisms." Now here, life in the early Heidegger is a term for Dasein, for human existence. Okay, so when Arendt is talking about life here, she's talking about this kind of radical transcendence, which can't be turned into an object of scientific study. And Arendt continues, "The future man projected by, you know, Promethean scientists, seems to be possessed by a rebellion against human existence as it has been given." The fact that human beings are living beings. A free gift from nowhere, secularly speaking, which he wishes to exchange, or the Promethean wishes to exchange, as it were, for something he has made himself. Okay? So, in other words, the sin of Prometheanism, or what is kind of reprehensible about Prometheanism, is its attempt to eliminate or destroy the precarious equilibrium between the given and the made, or between what human beings imminently generate through their own resources and what the way the world is. Whether cosmologically, biologically, or, you know, historically characterized. So you can draw some certain kind of, and, you know, certain interesting consequences follow from this denunciation of Prometheanism. So first of all, the fact that birth, suffering, and death are ineliminable constants of the human condition. Okay. So here Dupuy cites Ivan Ilyich, another thinker who again, you know, lays out this a similar critique. Ilyich writes, "We will never eliminate pain. We will not cure all disorders. We will certainly die. Therefore, as sensible creatures, we must face the fact that the pursuit of health may be a sickening disorder. There are no scientific or technological solutions. There is only the daily task of accepting the fragility and contingency of the human situation. There are reasonable limits which must be placed on conventional healthcare. Now, there's a couple of things to say here. One is that, interestingly, like, reason is unreasonable. This is the first objection made against Prometheanism, is that rationalism is pathological because it is unreasonable. According to a standard of reasonableness, which is actually conjured as the antithesis of rationality. Okay, so what exactly is reasonable about accepting the ineluctable facts of birth, suffering, and death? How much suffering should be accepted as an ineluctable or ineliminable feature of the human condition? You know, in the 13th century, you can be sure that, you know, the standard was less acceptable than it would be now. Okay, you need to think only of dentistry. Okay, to think about the issues raised about the relationship between quantity and quality in Ilyich's ontologization of these kind of, you know, biological facts. And here's a commentary by one of Ilyich's disciples. Okay, again, a very interesting quotation. It says, "What Jesus calls the kingdom of God stands above and beyond any ethical rule and can disrupt the everyday world in completely unpredictable ways. But Ilyich also recognizes in this declaration an extreme volatility. The fact that there's something radically unpredictable, or something that transcends, there's a degree of contingency, you know, for instance, in the fact of suffering, that transcends anything we can do about controlling and manipulating it. For should this freedom itself, should the indetermination of suffering as an existential datum ever become the subject of a rule, then the limitless would invade human life in a truly terrifying way." So in other words, once again, this is another, you know, interesting characterization of the pathology of Prometheanism. It tries to formulate a rule for what is without rule. It tries to conceptualize or organize that which is unconceptualizable, or that which is beyond every register of organization. And this is why then someone, you know, Dupuis, I think, you know, formulates this kind of perspective in its, you know, most kind of powerful form when he writes, "Man's symbolic health lies in his ability to cope consciously and autonomously not only with the dangers of his milieu, but also with a series of profoundly intimate threats that all men face and will always face, namely pain, disease, and death. The sacred played a fundamental role in this. The modern world was born on the ruins of traditional symbolic systems in which it could not see anything but arbitrariness and irrationality. In its enterprise of demystification, it did not understand the way these systems fixed limits to the human condition while conferring meaning upon them. When it replaced the sacred with reason and science, it not only lost all sense of limits, it sacrificed the very capacity to make sense." In other words, our ability to make sense of our lives and of our own existences. "One cannot make sense of what one seeks only to extirpate. If the naturally unavoidable finiteness of the human condition is perceived as alienation and not as a source of meaning, do we not lose something infinitely precious in exchange for the pursuit of a puerile dream?" What is, in other words, what is infinitely precious is the facticity of human existence that exposes us to disease, to suffering and death. This is infinitely precious. Okay? This is the root of all religion, okay? The claim that you're suffering for a reason. Be very wary when someone's telling you you're suffering for a reason, okay? So the nub of Dupuis' philosophical case against the Prometheanism he detects in this NBIC program can be traced not only, you know, back not only to Sartre, but to Cartesian dualism and the mechanical philosophy to which it gave rise. So the component and the contemporary philosophical complement to this metaphysical research program is the attempted mechanization of the mind, which underwrites much of cognitive science. Now, there are lots of debates about, you know, degree to which, you know, there are lots of different paradigms competing in cognitive science, and the computational paradigm has been subjected to, you know, numerous influential philosophical critiques. Dupuis is aware of this, but he still thinks that even things like connectionism still concede too much to this computational paradigm of the mind. This mechanization of the mind, this attempt to naturalize it, to naturalize the mind by understanding it as a part of nature. In other words, if nature itself is just this vast mechanism, or this kind of, you know, if one has a liberal sense of kind of machinery, you know, you can allow for very sophisticated and ingenious understandings of, mechanical causation. But you can integrate the mind into this mechanized nature through this computational paradigm. But it generates an immediate paradox. And a paradox is this, and again, this is Dupuis writing, the mind that carries out the mechanization and the one that is the object of it are two distinct, albeit closely related, entities, like the two ends of a seesaw, the one rising ever higher into the heavens of metaphysical humanism, because it says that, you know, human beings should be able to kind of understand and explain everything, as the other end descends further into its deconstruction, the deconstruction of humanism and of the privileges of the human being as traditionally conceived. For man to be able, as subject, to exercise a power of this sort over himself, it is first necessary that he be reduced to the rank of an object, able to be reshaped to suit any purpose. No raising up can occur without a concomitant lowering, and vice versa. Okay, so the upshot is this, is that the more we, and it's very simple, like the more we understand, the more we understand ourselves as part of nature, the more we successfully objectify ourselves as mechanisms, as very complicated mechanisms, the less able we become to delimit ends or purposes for ourselves, because we no longer know if we're no different from any other more or less complicated natural mechanism, then what is the point of all this explanation and understanding that we're engaged? Why are we trying to understand everything? What is the point of understanding ourselves if by understanding ourselves we understand that all the points that we elaborate to make sense of ourselves, the purposes through which we traditionally, oriented ourselves towards the future, are themselves senseless? They're just mechanisms. So this is the paradox, is that the more human beings understand themselves, the more we understand ourselves as just another kind of, contingently generated natural phenomenon, the less able we're able to define, say, what we should be. Because you've deprived yourself of the normative resources you need to be able to say, this is better than that, it's better to be like this than to be like that. Okay. Being elided in this, the disruption of this equilibrium between the given and the made, is the distinction between what is true for human beings insofar as they can control and manipulate it, and what is made, what is the way it is by virtue of its essence. The true and the made become convertible, okay? Because only what is made can be truly known. This is, again, why Marxism A philosophy that asserts the primacy of practice and of cognition as another kind of practice is guilty of eliding the distinction between what is made and what is known. Only what is humanly knowable must have been humanly made. Okay, so how much time do I have? I can wrap things up fairly. Okay. I'll just try and kind of come to some kind of conclusion. Now, what I want to insist is that, this is unfolding in a pretty abstract register, okay? But this claim about Dupuis insists that there's a paradigm, there's what is kind of genuinely kind of valuable in Judeo-Christianity is the positive analogy it establishes between divine creativity and human creativity. But in order to do this, he has to claim that everything has a distinct essence. And he reiterates the tale of the golem, okay? It's a mistake. What's wrong with Prometheanism is not that it's human beings, you know, arrogantly claiming to be able to do what God does, because he says the point about, you know, what's good about religion is it teaches you that there's a positive analogy between human creativity and divine creativity. So therefore, human beings might be able to produce life, a golem, a living creature. But in the parable that, you know, in a parable that Dupuis cites, which is too long to kind of to recapitulate here, he'll say that when the golem responds to the magician who's manufactured him, that by creating me, you've introduced a radical disorder into creation. You've done something, you've violated the distribution of essences, okay? Because there are now two things that exist, two living things that exist, but whose essence is indiscernible. So therefore, the golem immediately enjoins his creator to unmake him. In other words, even if you have the power to create life, you shouldn't do it, because if you could create an artificial life or a synthetic life, for instance, you know, cloning, to take the most kind of obvious example, is metaphysically dangerous because it seems to jeopardize the principle of the identity of indiscernibles. Okay, here you have two things that could be that seem to be identical in all their properties and characteristics, all their biological and psychological characteristics might be identical, but nevertheless, there would have to be there's a fundamental difference between them that can't be accounted for. The fact that there's two of them, not one. Okay, and according to Dupuis, this is, what is disturbing about Prometheanism is because by generating life, if you can manufacture life, which is singular and allegedly singular and incomparable, you have generated a rule for the ruleless. Okay? And this is what is objectionable about it. Now, but interesting, Dupuis doesn't say why. He just says, In the parable he cites, this is taken to be disturbing. The golem says you have introduced disequilibrium into the cosmos, into the nature of existence. But he doesn't say exactly what this disequilibrium consists in. And what I want to suggest is that it's precisely the assumption of equilibrium which is ultimately theological. The claim that there is a way of the world, or that reality has a kind of a determinate, that reality is kind of, that there is a ready-made world, even if we can't access or know it in itself, is precisely a theological presumption. The idea that the world was made, and it was made this way and not that way. Prometheanism is the attempt that we can make, you know, we can participate in the creation of the world, but without having to respect a divine blueprint. So in other words, if we introduce the disequilibrium that we will generate through our creative activity, is no more or less objectionable than the disequilibrium that is already there in reality. Finally, one final word. So, there's an account of rationality. Okay, Heidegger has a critique of rationality, which basically kind of characterizes a form of metaphysical voluntarism. What I want to propose is that there's a way of rehabilitating Prometheanism or philosophical Prometheanism, which understands rationality as rule-governed activity. So in other words, rationality is simply the faculty of generating rules and being bound by rules. And this is precisely the characterization of rationality provided by Kant. But these rules are not fixed in advance. They're not eternal and ahistorical. They are historically mutable. But the fact that they are historically mutable doesn't make them contingent in the same sense in which other historical phenomena are contingent. In other words, instead of like trying to recapture this theological equilibrium between immanence and transcendence, between the made and the given, the task is to recognize the stratification of immanence and the fact that there are structures of involution and of reflection within the natural order whereby rules or concepts or rationality itself can themselves can emerge out of physical patterns and processes. Okay, so this conception of rationality, of understanding, you understand rules as ways of coordinating and subsuming phenomena, but ways that can themselves be revised. In other words, they are themselves historically revisable. The way in which we understand the world and the way in which we change the world on the basis of our understanding is perpetually being redetermined. It's a kind of autocatalytic process which is about not trying to kind of reestablish an equilibrium, but getting beyond the opposition between order and disorder and recognizing that the catastrophes, the unforeseeable consequences of our technological ingenuity are not an objection to the desire to be able to kind of to foresee and control. Okay. So in other words, the fact that something has, in fact, there's a quote actually from Ballard. Ballard says that all becoming is savage, all progress is savage and violent. And the point about the story that the Voices of Time is that the cognitive progress made by the various protagonists in the story is savage and violent. But the fact that progress is savage and violent is not necessarily an objection to it, because there is indeed a savagery recapitulated in rationality, but it's a kind of sentimentalism to think that some savageries are not better than others. In other words, you can discriminate between savageries or modes of instrumentalization and say that some of them are just superior to others. And the claim that any attempt to kind of to circumscribe, delimit, manipulate is pathological is the kind of sentimentalism that just, you know, perpetuates the most objectionable characteristics of the so-called, you know, of our existence, the way we live. Okay? So you can either resign, we can either resign ourselves to this and say that's just the way the world is, or more interestingly, try to kind of re-examine, you know, I think the kind of the philosophical foundations of a Promethean project that is actually, you know, there in Marx, I think, this project of re-engineering reality, which is, you know, I think something that needs to be kind of, you know, reconsidered. And it's not, and, you know, the one thing to be said, you know, it's one of the great virtues of, you know, Badiou's philosophy is that he's one of the only people in recent years to have defended Prometheanism against this kind of, you know, this facile doxa, which has castigated it and chastised it for so long. And even if one disagrees with the details, the philosophical details of Badiou's account of the relationship between events and subjectivity, there is something nevertheless very, you know, very powerful. In other words, what's missing, the point would be to reconnect this account of the necessity of rational subjectivation to an analysis of biological, economical, and historical processes. Now, obviously a huge task, but the fact that it's a research program, it's a research program that I think whose philosophical legitimacy needs to be defended because it's too often simply dismissed as a fantasy. And it does have, and even if it does have, you know, phantasmatical residues, they can be diagnosed, analyzed, and perhaps, transformed on the basis of the analysis. Okay, everything is more or less phantasmatical. You know, you can't reproach a project for its kind of, you know, phantasmatical residues unless you yourself hold out the dream of something that is completely some model of rationality which would be wholly devoid of imaginary influences. And the point is not simply to oppose imagination and reason. The point is that reason is fueled by the imagination, but can also remake the limits of the imagination. Okay, I should stop.
So I would just ask if you have a question that you come down and ask the question into the microphone.
Less of a question and more something that I would like to expand and, you know, hone it to complete sharpness. First, I think, you know, the, as you said, the Dupuis critique is entails a kind of a foundationalist account of the system insofar as, you know, let's start with this idea that the system, what we understand the system is simply its systematic construction. That distills in its behavior. In other words, system is furnished with a modern kind of emptiness, and it's precisely this modern kind of emptiness that kind of, you know, cuts through this foundationalist account. And this is also something that Catherine brought it up, that you know, we can only object to the construction once we tether it to a foundationalist account of the system. Because this, there is systematicity, what we call the systematicity, is the rule of the construction. And this rule of the construction has, in fact, has its own functional hierarchy. But this functional hierarchy shouldn't be, imposed upon by some sort of, you know, a foundationalist account that, you know, creates this kind of a fundamentally myopic idea of what construction entails and what we should do with construction. So this is one thing. Now, this is what I'm going to, you know, take it to another step. Is that, you see, with the Ballard talk that you had. I think we both agree that, you know, in orienting ourselves toward the future, we need to treat this orientation as an extreme hypothesis. And this is, you know, by what I mean by extreme hypothesis, basically this is the logic of catastrophe that allows us to actually develop a logic of action and understanding of this. This is basically what manipulative or abductive hypothesis is. So in treating it as an extreme hypothesis, and there is no other way actually to understand, you know, orientation towards future, because any other form of orientation in fact curtail the scope of understanding and action implicit to the orientation as such. So this is the case. Now, it seems that, you know, the whole legacy of neoliberalism and foundationalism, not fundamentalism, foundationalism, it seems that they set themselves against this orientation and the kind of aesthetic demands that this orientation, and it's a vector of extreme hypothesis, demands both the individual and the collective to look beyond the localist immediate resources and opportunities that rest in past or present, the given, so on and so forth. Now, an example of this, as we have already discussed, seems to be really the idea of a space exploration as simultaneously being a conceptual limit posited against the overgrowing lineage of planetary myopias, and at the same time, a true rationalist collective form of construction. Now, we know that, in fact, you know, even mentioning something like space exploration brings the worst of both neoliberals and, you know, kitsch Marxist reactions as a pure fantasy, as something that is a vain enterprise. Now, the question is, why do you think that exactly this kind of these modes of action and understanding, which are implicit in the hypothetical vector of orientation, bring these kind of primal fears in this kind of political project? Is it just a fruit of an acute myopia, or is it? Do they really, you know, harbor some sort of a fundamental political edge?
So, just, I mean, the political edge of, you mean of the kind of neoliberal, you know, appropriation of this, of the possibility, technological feasibility of human enhancement. It's partly, I mean, yes and no. I mean, look, on one level, it's clear that the kind of the ideological justification is the claim that, these technologies of enhancement are simply continuing, or like, you know, the kind of the man, the human supplement to processes of selection that are already operative in the biological realm. So you get, you know, the metaphysics of the markets, the idea that, you know, kind of free markets are this kind of metaphysically ineluctable structure. Nature itself is just a bunch of markets. All life is, you know, competition over resources. So therefore, social competition and the kind of the ideal of competition kind of enshrined in the market, the play of market forces, is simply the kind of, you know, recapitulating, you know, a metaphysical fact. This is just the way the world is. So then the claim is that, you know, if we can now we're in a position to intervene in the kinds of resources that are available in the at the level of human competition, and of course, who's going to have access? Who's going to enhance themselves? You know, well, the people with, you know, vast amounts of money. All this research is being funded by, I mean, it's banal to, I mean, it's not an illuminating fact to point out. It's all being funded by governments, by corporations, by neoliberal think tanks. Now, So there's two. One can either kind of say that human enhanced, that this technology is itself politically contaminated. In other words, the desire to manipulate and control or to re-engineer is already politically objectionable. Okay, but if you do that, then you face a problem. Well, you say, well, look, we've been doing this for a long time, okay? We've been, you know, engineering ourselves, you know, more or less with you know, albeit kind of, you know, inefficiently for several millennia now. So where do you draw the line? At what point does our, you know, our kind of, you know, our refashioning become, you know, politically objectionable? So in other words, I think that the point is, you know, to insist that the technology itself is not innately evil. It's obviously being developed for, you know, its development is being kind of, it's the profit motive, okay? It's just some people wanting to kind of, you know, make more money. But that's, so, and that's the only politics that kind of, you know, the profit motive is, well, at least not the only, but kind of, you know, the overriding political factor here. So whether it deserves to be called political or not, but it's clear that simply kind of denouncing and pathologizing these new technologies is, it's a reprehensible position because you're just disempowering yourself. Because someone's gonna be doing this stuff. So you either engage with it and try to kind of say, well, is it possible to appropriate it? Could it be kind of repurposed and refashioned for emancipatory ends? Or is this, you know, is this kind of logic of re-engineering itself pathological? Okay, I want to suggest that it isn't, and it ought to be repurposed and refashioned for emancipatory ends. And everything I've talked about here, now I realize that, you know, I haven't said anything. The points, you have to, it's important to get the, you have to get the abstract critique out of the way before you can kind of set out the kind of the concrete practical conditions, it seems to me. Because otherwise it's easy to kind of cut this off at the knees through this kind of Heideggerian critique. I don't know if I answered all your question, but...
I would like to go back to a question of legitimacy of reason. For if all savages are equally valid, then what would make one savagery more equal than the others?
If
you said that all savages are indiscernibly equal, at least you alluded to a certain doxa that exists.
All savagery is, all savagery
is, yes.
Yeah,
so what
is,
would
yes.
make one of them, that is reason, more equal than the others? I mean, what would validate it as a legitimate philosophical project? And at least it seems for me that the current doxa is that it couldn't, or at it is not celebrated as one that could be philosophically privileged. And in your question, I would like to ask that the reasons for it that we could bring to it should be purely philosophical rather than practically or politically validated as a project of emancipation or any other political reason.
Okay, I'll try and answer it. Correct me if I'm not answering your question. I'll try and answer it. To say that not all savageries, that, you know, that's the term, you know, savage and brutal, that's Ballard's term for describing kind of progress. The claim that not all savageries are equal is simply the claim that you can use norms to say, so we've known since Freud that reason is animated by drives, the drive to dominate, aggression. There are all sorts of libidinal impulses that fuel even highly abstract intellectual activity. Okay, now, but that's not an indictment of that activity. The fact that conceptual rationality can be is libidinally invested and kind of, you know, inflected by these drives is not a kind of, you know, doesn't disqualify it, unless you think that drives are innately reprehensible. And why would you believe that? Why would you not discriminate between desirable, sublimated drives? So let's say that the desire to kind of, you know, if conceptualizing means dominating, okay, well, there's some things, you know, it's good to dominate diseases and germs and polio, okay? You don't want to let those things, you know, be in whatever way they might happen to want to be. So that's, it's as simple as that. I'm saying that, you know, and I'm not... You know, I don't want to have a kind of, you know, I think that psychoanalysis and Freud in particular is perfectly kind of, is a kind of an annex of this rational project. It's reason reason trying to understand its own irrational or kind of pathological residues. But that's good. I mean, that allows you to, you know, to understand and maybe to kind of, you know, to identify possible kind of, you know, distortions, you know, generated by these unconscious factors. But that, again, like when I say about the need to integrate contingency, there's nothing, you know, contingency should neither be fetishized as some kind of metaphysical absolute, nor should it be simply kind of viewed as something, you know, that as a pathological contaminant. The point is to kind of, to you know, appropriate contingency and let it do its work in a way that can be, that is execrable and that, you know, furthers the resources of understanding. So otherwise, if you say that all savagery is just savagery, well, and then you say that, you know, if you go down, you know, then you're going down the Nietzschean route, you've got genealogical critique, and you say that, well, even the instinct of morality is itself driven by, you know, cruelty, resentment, you know, all these things. But Nietzsche's point is that that's not, you know, you can't, you know, denounce moralism coherently, okay? You can't give a moral critique of morality. Okay, you can't say that reason is bad because it's all about kind of domination, unless you have resources to explain why, you know, domination is bad that are independent of reason. So this is what, you know, I'm trying to kind of say when I say that the savagery and brutality of progress and of cognitive progress is something that needs to be. It needs to be described and explained, not denounced and calumniated.
So my question has to do with, like, if Marx is part of this project, how are we going to liberate Marx from this tradition of, like, post-war Western Marxism, which you somehow refer to it as kitsch Marxism or like folk Marxism, people use it, or like how are we going to do that?
Well, the point wouldn't be to kind of denounce or dismiss that, you know, there's a complicated history, and like it's a long-term project. This is like something I'm interested in working through. It involves, you know, a kind of engagement with that tradition. I mean, there are reasons, and they're very, you know, complicated historical reasons why, you know, Western Marxism, you know, developed the way it did. And, you know, at the time, you know, but, so like, if you take a book like Dialectic of Enlightenment, okay, which obviously where this kind of, you know, critique of, this identification of rationality with domination is kind of articulated. That seemed to be kind of, you know, kind of a historically warranted critique. People who, you know, defendants of that book will say, well, when they were writing, you know, in the middle of the Second World War, you know, the historical conditions were such as to kind of, you know, make that a very kind of necessary and timely analysis. Then unfortunately, it wasn't rectified, or at least it seems that it's been taken up, and it's, you know, contingent historical kind of articulation has not been has not led people to kind of to try to rectify its thesis. They've been absolutized, and they're simply kind of accepted as like, you know, just verities about what's wrong with reason. I think it can be done, but I think there's, you know, there's a huge, you know, I think Marx's work itself is this vast, incredibly, you know, vast, complicated edifice whose relationship to philosophy I'm interested in kind of elaborating. But it seems to me that there are kind of, you know, there's a kind of Western Marxism which becomes just kind of, the opposition between kind of, you know, philosophy and critical theory is complicated because of the philosophical contradictions that begin to kind of, you know, vitiate the project of critical theory and the claim that, you know, so, but I'm not saying, no, I'm not junking, I don't want to kind of simply denounce all that stuff. It's very important, but it has been, there's a kind of a cartoon version of it, which is very kind of pernicious.
Much as sort of like the Marxists sort of like rejecting progress or rejecting thinking about future, but to outsource this to bad people. I'm just simplifying it, right? So it's like the technology of capital or even science can keep imagining the future, and we will be outside afterwards critique it or like constantly problematize it. I think that's the problem. So denying philosophers to do that, or denying the category of politics to do that, and allowing the market, or like even the science to do that. This whole separation, sort of like allowing the scientific image to do it, while the other one will critique it. So I think it's not like they completely reject it. It's just that it's been outsourced to the bad people who are good at doing the bad stuff, and the good people will do the good stuff, which is the critique.
Who's outsourced the? You mean the?
Yeah. The Western Marxism after World War II, sort of like this. I could be like wrong, but I'm just suggesting that like could be this type of like unwritten agreement that like that the task of imagining future is outsourced to the capital and to maybe science, which is funded by capital, and then the task of the philosopher or like the critic is to look at what's being done and constantly problematize it and critique it rather than participate in imagining the future.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd say. I guess the one, look, I mean, there's a kind of, you know, like in, you get this kind of thing, the prohibition on any positive characterization of utopia in, you know, in kind of late Adorno is, I think that's understandable. In other words, he doesn't want to, you know, what I admire about Adorno is his resistance, his kind of resistance to the lure of false reconciliation. And what's good about Adorno is this, the claim that, you know, we shouldn't, reconciliation is always deception, okay? So like, you know, the point about affirming the unreconcilable. But it seems to me that there's a kind of resignation, which is itself a kind of reconciliation. You reconcile yourself to the unreconcilable by saying there's nothing to be done. And saying there's nothing to be done, and if you try to do anything, you'll just bring about the worst, is a kind, it's tragic resignation, which is just another, it's a very, it might be a ethically superior form of reconciliation, but I don't want to be reconciled. I don't believe in reconciliation, which is why I'm interested in, you know, reactivating this program of practice, because otherwise it's too easy to kind of, you know, you disrupt the danger of reconciliation by reopening some kind of possibility of some kind of, you know, intervention, however kind of dangerous and kind of problematic it might be.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on the question about the relationship between Marxism, or actually Marx, and Prometheanism. And I wonder to what extent the theme of Prometheanism is determined by its, I mean, obviously it is historically, but by its antagonism to a particular form of abstract domination, which is religion. Mm-hmm. So, hypothetically, I mean, I think it would be possible to somewhat periodize Marx's own relationship to the question of Prometheanism in a way that builds on what you've said, but might render it a little more complex. So if you take the Prometheanism of the very early Marx as being in a mold of fairly straightforwardly radical Enlightenment, young Hegelianism, and so on, then I think the question becomes very peculiar when you pass from the criticism of heaven to the criticism of the earth, and you have the manifesto where, of course, the subject of Prometheanism is the bourgeoisie. That's where you already get this very peculiar ambivalence. The one subject, which up to now has mutated, transformed the world, is not clearly the working class. It's not species being or humanity as such. It is this, world-oriented agent. By the later Marx, that's dropped out as well, because actually the bourgeoisie is a fairly miserable and fractious entity, and therefore it becomes, to an extent, capital as an automatic subject. That's the, so when you get to the Grundrisse, the concentration of science, the transformation of the world, is not, of course, it's based on the theft of labor and theft of workers' knowledge and so on, but the subject is, the subject of that transformation is in a sense, in a complex sense, capital. And that puts Prometheanism in a kind of a bind, because you're not simply trying to undo the abstract domination of a force like religion or the state or politics for the sake of human knowledge. You're stuck in the dialectical recognition that the subject of world transformation is in a complex and, in a complex manner, the alienation of people's work itself. Which then, it has put a lot of Marxists in a bind, because of course it has put Marx himself in a bind, because then it's like, but, the great works of humankind end up being also simply the byproducts, the excrescences of capital's logic of accumulation. They're not because human beings have, reached for the stars and for enlightenment. So I was wondering what you thought about that, because I think it's quite complex mode. And then the second thing is just a bit of a corollary, because I know you're very interested in the work of Sebastiano Timpanado, and I wonder if there isn't a different lineage, not maybe anti-Prometheanism is probably not the right term, but a way of criticizing a certain conception of infinite mastery or what have you, without referring to finitude in a Kantian Heideggerian transcendental sense, but in a much more naturalist sense. So Timpanado's sort of pessimistic Leopardi meets Marx naturalism is something, for me, I don't necessarily find it entirely persuasive, but it's something I think is quite different than that Dupuy line. And it's an old, it's a kind of ancient Greek materialist and very Enlightenment inspired. So I was wondering what you thought about that other
line. Okay. Well, regarding the first question, this involves having to kind of, confront all these, sophisticated accounts of the fact that capitalism's status as this kind of is it that you wouldn't, you're not going to want to say that capitalism is a subject of history, but it has become this kind of, the motive force of contemporary. It's no longer kind of, the motive force is no longer associated or kind of at the level of, anything that, it's as if human beings have relinquished their kind of, practical and kind of, their agency to some level, to the agency of this kind of abstract, machinery that the value. And that's, obviously that's correct, okay? And that needs to be, and I think, that's the biggest challenge to this reassertion of Prometheanism, is the claim that, well, what if it's too late? What if there's kind of, the conditions, the social and historical conditions under which some kind of transformative praxis, could be elaborated, are just not are just not available anymore. And it, so, I mean, I acknowledge, you know, the kind of the accuracy. I mean, you know, I take this stuff very, very seriously, and it's stuff I need to kind of engage with. And I don't have, right now, I don't have a kind of a response to it. But it seems to me that there's a problem. What becomes of Marxism as kind of, you know, famous, you know, if... I do think you have to be careful about recognizing kind of the complicated dynamic between kind of system, kind of, you know, systemic agency and the kind of the, you know, agency at the kind of the human level. If there's a complete or radical dissociation, and, you know, if capitalism is the only subject, you know, if capitalism is now the transcendental subject, and obviously there's not much, you know, then it seems to me that, you know, the dangerous kind of melancholy, defeatism, all you can do is expose this, okay? But it seems to me it's very, but then what has become of, you know, the kind of the connection between theory and practice, the claim that thinking is itself a kind of activity? Because once you've diagnosed the fact that, you know, this machinery is now so powerful, so all-consuming, that there's no room for us to kind of, and which is actually true. I mean, this is why, you know, the rejoinder to any kind of naive kind of voluntarism or spontaneity, I mean, is necessary. But I think you can't, it can't be used. I mean, the problem, I think, is the problem of subjectivation. If the proletariat is no longer kind of, it seems incredible to try to kind of, you know, characterize the proletariat as the kind of, you know, the locus of kind of human species being, which will kind of, you know, challenge the hegemony of capitalism, then, you know, you need to kind of, well, I mean, maybe you don't, but it seems to me that you would need to kind of, if you try to kind of come up with an alternative account of subjectivation, and this is what I'm really interested in, the relationship between system and subject, between capitalism as a system and subjectivity, but without one that doesn't kind of simply say, you know, it's the proletariat, but neither does it simply say, does it kind of say, well, they're just these, but I don't want to accept an evental account, where they're just these evental. And so I don't have a theory of the subjects, but I think you need one for emancipatory politics. And I think the weakness of this kind of systemic analysis is that, or no, it's not a weakness, it's not an analytical weakness, it's an incredibly powerful analytical system. But then, as you know, the kind of, it can also kind of accommodate itself to a kind of a politics of a very dubious, you know, logic. Well, this is the best we can hope for, like, you know. And for just a quick word about the second question, which was about, sorry, just remind me what this...
Timpanaro.
Yeah, I love Timpanaro. But the thing, I'm more of an idealist than he is. That doesn't mean to say I'm not a materialist. I'm an idealist because I really like thinking. And I'm interested in the possibility that there's more things to think and discover. Which is why there's a kind of, again, I mean, I respect, there's a kind of really admirable kind of pessimism, you know, materialist pessimism. But again, I'm very wary of the lure of resignation. And I'm unwilling to resign myself to anything that's where I suspect that, well, you know, maybe there's more to discover about this, or we don't quite, the facts, you know, the facts of the matter are not all in about this. And about our biological nature, I think that is particularly true. So.
I just wanted to pick up, I guess, on this question of a set of somewhat unspoken, I think, sort of collocations that are here, which have to do with the relation between a sort of resignation, a historical period, which you could call something like Western Marxism or a certain mm-hmm. term, and then the question, let's say, of relatively complicated scientific practice, understood mm-hmm. also as things that only capital funds. And, you know, this is a problem that I find a lot of that stuff that people want to talk about is accelerationism, which mm-hmm. I find crap, totally. And I find it crap for a number of reasons, but one of which is that it basically it sets up a false link between a certain form of the resignation of, so to say, Promethean processes, right, with negativity. And then on the other hand, it has something like, if we intervene, it'll look like social democracy, right? And it's sounding like a TED talk to become stewards of advanced processes of capital, which is alarmingly unaware of ongoing critiques of technological objectivism. You get this in the Italian tradition, you get this much earlier in terms of Luxembourg's critique of Bernstein, et cetera. And what it misses that you could imagine a Promethean labor of negation that has nothing to do with resignation, but you know, a way to understand the tradition of, let's say, Western Marxism you were grasping, I mean, all the thinkers seeing this moment, this seeming kind of closure, the tautology of capital to itself, which is a material process, what they're recognizing is simply that it's harder and harder to fathom building a counter system within the same space of the built world, because you can't separate, so to say, the abstractions of capital from its material edifices. So while there's, you know, we have an Adornian take on the one hand, you can also imagine another tradition that says that what we've hit is a moment where Promethean labor will not be that of the development of more productive forces, but a profoundly creative and massively organized process of the dismantling of that world towards other ends.
Okay.
So I just want to stress that I think there's sometimes a false association with something like the a very rationally directed hostility and antagonism towards capital, which is important. There's often an automatic link between that and certain forms of nanotech, biotech, etc. And I think this misses the fact that we need to understand that you could equally fathom a Promethean work of a very serious disruption of, let's say, flows of capital and the further kind of filling of the world. So that's...
Okay. So I'm not suggesting that simply kind of, taking hold, that the solution, the way to kind of overthrow capitalism is by kind of investing in this stuff or like appropriating, reading up on this stuff and then kind of, that's the key, the key to revolutionary practice is simply kind of, technological sophistication. That's not what I'm suggesting. Accelerationism, yes, it's a kind of, it's a problematic term because it's always ambivalent what exactly is being accelerated, by whom, to what end, and, is associated, in its Landian form, it leads to kind of, it's not that the consequences are just kind of morally reprehensible, it's just that they're kind of uninteresting and kind of, a bizarre kind of, really kind of unpleasant, dogmatic kind of, the reassertion of kind of atavisms, actually. The reassertion of kind of, political atavisms. So the claim is not the kind of, what to do about capitalism. It's not just by kind of, all becoming, becoming technologically literate and proficient is simply kind of inadequate and insufficient. But, okay, so the question is, like, if you dismantle capitalism, because, the claim, Marx says, there's a transfer, there must be kind of, it's capitalism itself will generate the resources that will kind of provide us, that will facilitate a transition to a communist world. If you're simply dismantling capitalism, also, to what end? And how are you dismantling it, and what are you dismantling it for? You don't want to go back. I mean, presumably no one wants to go back. No one wants to go back to a pre-capitalist, feudal or agrarian society. I mean, I don't think that that is... I seriously don't think that anyone wants to kind of, return to those kind of conditions. So I agree with you completely that the challenge is to kind of, we want to dismantle capital, but no one knows how to do it, and sabotage and kind of just local kind of, blowing up rail tracks or kind of that kind of stuff, it seems to me of limited, it's just kind of jamming up its gears. It's not a revolutionary praxis. And it's a poor substitute for revolutionary praxis. I'm not saying, but it's desirable, as opposed to kind of, again, simply kind of capitulating and saying there's nothing to be done. But I think the question about what is to be done is, it's still, is a very serious one. And I think, look, I completely accept your account of the Prometheanism of kind of rejection, negation, And especially, like, you know, I mean, the struggles of the dispossessed and kind of, you know, there is a heroism, actually. There's a genuine heroism in use in people struggling to overthrow regimes of oppression, you know, that they have with, you know, little or not, with their bare hands, often with very kind of limited resources. The point is that if you could marry that kind of political will to the right resources and to some kind of full-blown, you know, some kind of project or program, then, you know, the revolutionary program might be kind of, you might be able to kind of scale up again, okay, to a kind of genuine, to an overthrowing of capitalism, which does not entail the reinstoration of pre-capitalist modes of organization. I mean, and I, but by that I mean, like, I just think, yes, I know that it's kind of, you know, wage labor is, you know, profoundly reprehensible, you know, it's just, you know, I completely kind of accept the critique of wage labor, property, you know, and I think, but all, you know, it should be possible to come up with the resources to marry this animus, you know, the loathing of capitalism with some kind of, you know, positive kind of, some, you know, cognitive, some positive transformation of human existence.
So my question is how to establish norms or what the condition would be. So just as a recapitulation for the reason of that question, norms would provide the guide to what should be rather than what is. Uh-huh. So they kind of provide the ambition or the cause or the injunction against the misery of the present, right? But so your demand is essentially around a deontological dimension, provide a kind of a moral condition towards emancipation. But my question would be, well, why norms rather than some other notion? Insofar as if your challenge is to say, well, there is no condition of equilibrium in the first place, and therefore talk of disequilibrium already concedes too much to theological criteria for what is. Emancipation through reason, presumably for you, happens through an alienation against the present or against the past in its demeaning, denigrating aspects, right? But I don't understand how you could establish norms per se, insofar as norms agree sort of amount to social conventions which have been established. So what I wonder is, in your demand for what you're calling a normative dimension, established through reason, whether in calling it normative, you concede too much to the Enlightenment, which would have assumed social agreement in terms of what reason would have established. And in assuming, in conceding too much to an Enlightenment model of what reason can provide, you don't abjure from a more radical project than the radical Enlightenment. Because it seems to me alienation is actually another name for counter-normative injunctions.
Okay, yeah. Again, I'm not suggesting that, I don't want to, okay, I mean, part of the account, okay, is that, you know, reason has a kind of a normative dimension, okay, so that as the word normative, as I use it, just means anything that is rule-governed, but rule-governed in a way that is that can be adjudicated using other rational resources. So in other words, the claim is that there's ways of thinking, there's ways of discriminating, there's ways of valorizing, but they're not simply kind of handed down or accepted. They've been fashioned and revised and refined over history. By norms, there are social and cultural norms, which are obviously pathological and
reprehensible and which need to be repudiated, but you can only repudiate them using by saying they're wrong, okay? So they're, you know, they're wrong, unjust, or whatever. So in other words, in order to revise something, you need some kind of normative resources to kind of to denounce or reject practices, oppression, whatever. Okay, but however, you're right. There's a basic problem in that because they're not, you know, they're not fallen from the sky. So they're, you know, they've been fashioned by human practices, so that they're not pure, they're not uncontaminated by these undesirable kind of oppressive determinants. So, are norms sufficient? No, but first of all, there's no such thing as norms. You have to be careful. Like, I'm not saying that you can. All I mean is simply kind of conceptual rationality, okay? The ability to criticize, define, analyze, argue, okay? It's a really very formalist, very skeletal, you know, when I talk about normativity, I just mean something extremely attenuate and very formal, okay? I don't mean, you know, social, historical, customs, practices, or anything like that. All I'm saying is that in order to think critically, about anything, and in order to, you know, to try to kind of align means and ends, and to kind of to say, you know, this is better than that, you need normative resources in this sense, okay? But they're not sufficient because this account can be criticized for its formalism, okay? Because of this purely formal conception of critical rationality, you could say it doesn't. It's insufficient to be able to, you know, to generate the kinds of concrete, you know, distinctions that you need to be able to do to kind of carry out some kind of emancipatory political, and that's entirely possible. They might be insufficient, but they're still necessary. I don't think there's anything. I mean, in other words, even if they're not, the account is schematic and impoverished, which I don't deny. It is, but I'm still trying to identify what I take to be, you know, indispensable, okay, and what needs to be kind of fleshed out or substantiated. So yes, I agree that, you know, the account is radically insufficient, but the resource of, you know, rationality, I think, is indispensable, and it's not, again, it's not about opposing theory and practice, realizing that, you know, reasoning is something we do, and it's something we can do, you know, better or worse, and it can allow us to. There's lots of things we can achieve, you know, through this kind of practical cognitive rationality, including, you know, lots of what we, you know. Lots of the achievements of kind of, you know, human technological ingenuity, which are really extraordinary when you think about it. I mean, it's not. I think it takes a kind of. We should be more. You know, I think they are kind of. It's astonishing what, you know, human beings have managed to achieve. And you might say that it's kind of, which puts the lie to the claim that they're really no better than ants or roaches. They are interestingly distinct, and it's sentimental to say that there's no difference, that they're no better than ants. It's just kind of, that is a kind of, you know, sentimentalism, I think. Since we are better, then why not try and do something about it?
Thank you so much for joining us. I also just wanted to make a quick announcement because Ray is going to be speaking tomorrow night with Suhail Malik and Reza Nagaristani, and this is at 88 Eldridge Street on the fourth floor in New York. It starts at 7 o'clock tomorrow. So thanks everyone for coming, and thank you especially for being here.